is everybody out there? Hope you all are good. Happy New Year and welcome to Doc Talk. It's the first of the year. I'm so excited. We have a great show planned today. This is Carol Martori, by the way, your host once a month. And I want to welcome my great friend and collaborator, Jacob Rosenberg, director extraordinaire. Hello.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad that you're here with me.
Absolutely.
So, Jacob and I have worked together on a couple films. I think I've talked to you guys about them, Waiting for Lightning, about Danny Way, professional skateboarder, and Distortion of Sound, about sound quality and the impact of compression on sound quality. And it's a pleasure to have you here because today we have a great show. We are going to be talking about Errol Morris, who is a very influential documentary filmmaker and very important to both of us, and very important, became very important as we were creating and making Waiting for Lightning. We found our mutual love for him. And so basically we want to talk about From Thin Blue Line to Wormwood. So for those of you who don't know, Morris's latest film or series or whatever
film.
You want film. Let's call it film. Okay, let's call it a film because it's 4 hours long,
yeah,
a little over 4 hours. And that's on Netflix right now, streaming.
Yeah.
So feel free to binge watch that.
I think that's the way to watch it, is to try to sit through it as I did in one sitting.
Yeah.
To really digest the details and the mastery that's at work.
Yeah, absolutely. So I concur with that. And so basically, I want to just kind of, for those of you who don't know, I want to introduce you to a little bit of Errol Morris. I'm going to give you a little background on each of the films, and we're starting with Thin Blue Line. And then Jacob and I are going to jump into it because we have a lot to cover in this discussion on these films. And so Errol Morris is a documentary film director, as I've noted. He has done Gates of Heaven, Thin Blue Line, Brief History of Time, Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, Mr. Death, Fog of War, which he won an Oscar for in 2003, Standard Operating Procedures, Tabloid, The Unknown Known, and many others, and now Wormwood. He also directs commercials, and his iconic commercials for Max Switch campaign, for many of you who know and love that campaign, I certainly did. His influence is far and wide. You don't even really have to, you know, go that far from The Jinx to Man on Wire to many, many others and radio as well. And so, you know, we could go on and on about that. But his filmmaking is just, I think, one of the most important works in filmmaking ever made, and very important to me as not just a filmmaker but as a truth seeker. And hopefully a truth teller. He's important not only to documentary filmmaking, but feature as well. I can't say enough about him and my praise for him. But I kind of want to touch a little bit more personally, like basically, Jacob, like how did you even come to know him as a filmmaker?
Well, I went to Emerson College in Boston in the mid-1990s, and I was very fortunate to have a professor by the name of James Lane, who attended Harvard, was a documentary filmmaker at Harvard, and ended up at Emerson College. And I took a class called Documentary Now, and I'd say the only thing relevant to the context of this is that I grew up making skateboard videos, which, you know, in a certain highfalutin conversation are documentaries in and of themselves. I mean, I went out, I documented the people in directly in front of me. I edited that material together and documented that moment in time and created a time capsule that persists. So there is a little bit of an initial pull towards the medium for me, or towards that genre of filmmaking. And so I took a Documentary Now class, and, you know, of course, we started with Nanook of the North, and start going through the history of documentary, the films made during World War II that there was a wonderful Netflix documentary about recently, the Why We Fight films. Mm-hmm. And then we started to get into, I think, Professor Lane's real sort of like personal connection to documentary. Mm-hmm. And we started to watch the early 1950s reportage documentary work where journalists were going to the South during the Civil Rights Movement and really uncovering the humanity of stories down there, mm-hmm. that was being overlooked. And these were, you know, white Harvard, you know, scholars going down there and pointing their camera in a reportage fashion. From there, there were two films that just kind of shook me to my core. One of the films is called David Holtzman's Diary, and it's actually a fictional film by L.M. Kit Carson. And the film was extraordinary for me because it sort of took what was a small movement that was going on at Harvard at the time with Ed Pincus, of filmmakers turning the camera on themselves and actually like documenting their life and telling the story of what's happening in their life as a means of crafting a narrative and showing the narratives that exist in their life.
Right.
So David Holtzman's Diary, for me as a young filmmaker going to film school, consuming everything, I'm watching Kurosawa, I'm watching Kozlowski, I'm just eating everything up. And I see David Holtzman's Diary, and it's a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to the end of it, and the professor says, it's not a doc. It's actually a scripted film that was just living in the aesthetic of this self-reflexive cinema that was developing at the time.
Wow.
So it has shades of verite in it. So that's a nugget for me that was huge just in my development. The next thing I saw was Ed Pincus's Diaries. And Ed Pincus's Diaries, I think it's a 4 or 6 hour series, very hard to find. I don't even know if it exists outside of scholarly circles.
Yeah.
And that piece of work just shook me to the core as well. Mm-hmm. This was a man who put his life, I mean, he's naked with his wife, his children, his babies, and it's really about his migration from Harvard up into Maine or wherever is north from Boston, and it sort of shows his leaving of the city and accepting of a different life.
Right.
So Ed Pincus's Diaries was really, you know, seminal for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then he showed us Silver Lake Life, The View from Here.
Oh, right.
Which is, you know, a Sundance Award-winning film, incredibly uncomfortable to watch if you've never seen anyone die before. And you know, but it's a powerful film.
Yeah.
And these were all very self-reflexive films that I was consuming, and I was really sucking it up and lapping it up.
Yeah.
And then the professor plays The Thin Blue Line. And as a young film student, I just didn't know what to think except that I just loved it.
Yeah.
And I just, for me, I love that there's this conversation now, at least that Morris is having online, about reenactments and the interpretation of the work and why are you calling it this and why are you calling it that. Mm-hmm. These are films.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for me, why The Thin Blue Line is so effective is because it does the great things that movies do, which is to provoke and evoke emotion and intellectual, you know, connection through a series of images and then recall or regenerate those images as a way of building a deeper connection with the material.
Right.
And for me, Morris's mastery of the shot selection of the reenactments, of the capturing of the interviews, and this is all stuff that I want to discuss when we get into it.
Yeah.
For me, that I was like, I'm not watching a documentary. I was just watching a film that I couldn't stop watching.
Right.
And I think that was it for me.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Fog of War came out, which is another seminal work.
Yeah.
I saw that at the Sunset Theater, and I remember, again, I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
The first-person addressing of the camera, the awkwardness that existed that was so penetrating.
Yep.
And then I was fortunate enough to briefly work on SOP, so I saw a little bit behind the curtain of the process of creating some of those reenactments and some of those visual elements.
Oh, wow.
On a lot in Hollywood. And I just sort of, I guess I feel like he is a filmmaker's filmmaker.
Yeah, definitely. I agree.
In that way, like, forget documentary, forget this. Like, yes, he tells documentary stories, but he is a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And his mastery of vocabulary and cinematic grammar deserves to be studied.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
You know, I think one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you is because when I finish watching a work that hits me as hard as it does, I want to talk about it with the people that I love and the people that I work with.
Yeah.
As a means of, we're not right or wrong about his intent.
Yeah.
But we're figuring out things that help us be better storytellers or help us, you know, dive in. I think I took a note, and it's like, you know, one of the great joys as a director or a filmmaker is watching someone make great decisions.
Yeah. Yes.
That you didn't think of.
Exactly.
And of course you didn't think of it because you're not them. But, like, just seeing it, it's like you're – I mean, and there's moments where when I was rewatching Thin Blue Line, I'm cheering.
Yeah.
Or there's moments in Wormwood where I'm just – I want to pull my hair out.
Yeah.
I'm so riveted. So that's my – that's my connection, you know, initially to Morris's work and sort of my love for him as one of the 20th century's, you know, great storytellers. And 21st now, too, of course.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, 69 and in his prime.
Yes.
So basically, and I came about him from another direction because I didn't go to film school. And so for me, you know, I studied psychology and sociology, as you well know, and I was introduced to him in my first job, which was on working with Wolfgang Hastert. And he's like, it's all about Errol Morris. That's it. I was like, okay, like, who's this guy? So we watched, you know, his films, and Thin Blue Line was the first one. And I was completely riveted because my whole thing, for me personally, was the study of why are we the way we are? Mm-hmm. How do we come to be this way as individuals in our own psychology bits? How did the society in which we live influence and impact that? And to me, that's what he's getting at. I mean, it's epistemology, too. It's mm-hmm. the study of knowledge.
Deeply.
And his films aren't just about that event or that issue. It is about how we construct truth, how we build knowledge, how belief impacts that as well.
The emotional registration of information.
Yes. So that just, it was like catnip to me, someone like me, studying all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
You know, like I had already been into documentary and wanted to pursue that as a career. But once that was introduced, it was this perfect marriage of intellect and art and artistry to me.
Yeah.
And I was like very compelled by that.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, emotion, that emotional Larry, which is so powerful. So I think like let's just jump into Thin Blue Line mm-hmm. here because I just want to give a brief synopsis so for those of you who don't know this film. It came out in 1988, 30 years ago, guys. Okay.
Yeah.
Still powerful. I rewatched it. I was still entranced. It's a whodunit in the most basic ways, in a certain way. You're introduced at the top of the film to the two main characters, Randall Adams and David Harris. And you are right away discuss how their paths crossed. And you're right away in this story.
Yeah.
It's this back and forth between the two of them. And you're like, okay. You're like, all right, what's going to happen? You just know the shoe's going to drop. And then, boom, he drops it. And you're already seeing it through the visuals,
yeah.
right? And it's the murder of a police officer. And Randall Adams is convicted for that murder. But did he really do it? And so that's where you kind of begin this journey with Morris.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what you write me a text, and you're
yeah.
like, Wormwood is the bookend
yeah.
to Thin Blue Line.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think that when you sit down and watch a movie that's done right, every time you rewatch it, you glean elements of why you felt that way in the first place. I've been overwhelmed by the movies that have been come out recently. I saw Phantom Thread in 70mm, and there's an incredible restraint that Paul Thomas Anderson has for the amount of visual flair that he is used to implementing in these stories. And you just are watching someone who is so clear about what they're doing. And when I watched Wormwood, I texted you right away as you're my doc brother, and I was like, dude, this is insane.
Mm-hmm.
This deserves to be celebrated. This deserves to be discussed for all the right reasons, because there's a part of it that probably could have a similar backlash, which is ridiculous,
mm-hmm.
that was similar to what the Thin Blue Line encountered in terms of not being taken seriously as a quote-unquote documentary. So for me, when I watched The Thin Blue Line again, there was a couple things that came up, and the reason why I think it's the bookend, the right bookend, is one, I think that The Thin Blue Line is a classic Hollywood detective story,
mm-hmm.
to the point that in the film, there is a character, the witness, who's talking about how she dreams of being a detective.
Mm-hmm.
And you see these sort of like, you know, key lit,
mm-hmm.
you know, shots of 40s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, detective films,
mm-hmm.
And that is the movie that Errol Morris is making.
Right.
He is making a send-up to these classic detective stories. The visual language
yeah.
of the reenactments is consistent with the simplicity of the visual language of those stories, almost to the point where the woman is shooting the camera directly at the screen, which
yeah.
is a throwback to the old Western, you know, with the character shooting directly into the camera.
Right.
So for me, he puts so many breadcrumbs to tell you what the film is.
Yeah.
And there's all these elements of it is a detective story.
Yeah.
Now, if you move to Wormwood as the bookend on the other side of that, you have an epic crime thriller.
Right.
Epic. And the visuals match that notion of it being an epic. It's like you have a film noir and then you have a neo post-film noir. I don't even know how to categorize what it is.
Right.
But it is the most syrupy, delicious, you know, incredibly well, incredibly disciplined, you know, photographed. The drama in Wormwood lives up to the fact that if you look at Thin Blue Line, detective story, you look at Wormwood, this is a detective story as well.
Yeah.
And the scales are just, it's just changed. He's matured as a filmmaker. Ugh. The visual language has matured. He's been, he's able to do so much more.
Yeah.
But the pieces and the bones are right there.
They are.
You have interviews with people on camera. You have insert shots of maps, of articles, of details, and the score, even though it's Philip Glass on the first film and not Philip Glass in this film,
right,
is unmistakably whipping you into a symphony of, you know, of movement and momentum. So again, that's sort of the simple way of saying why they you know match each other with bookends. But I think getting into the Thin Blue Line and why I feel like, you know, when you watch a filmmaker like that at work, you're really learning, or you can learn, is just right away. So you said the film starts, you see Adams and Harris being interviewed. So just for me as a filmmaker, when I look at that, the first thing I see Randall Adams. He is in front of a wire backdrop. He is wearing all white. Okay, I don't know if he had control over the wardrobe.
Right.
But here's, it's like filmmakers. Here's, take note. Like, what is the person in white in those old crime movies is the good guy.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And then you cut to David Harris.
Yep.
They made a conscious choice to light the backdrop behind him red.
Right.
He's wearing an orange or red colored jumpsuit.
Yeah. Orange.
And so right away. You see a distinction in the depiction of these two people. So for me, and I'll tell you, like, I'll watch a movie, and I don't just sit there and analyze this minutia. It's when you watch it again and again, and you really want to get under the surface of what's going on.
Right.
But their eye lines are also off as well.
Yeah.
Randall Adams looks to the left, and Harris looks to the right. It's just absolute, just incredibly intelligent filmmaking where someone is making the right choices. And all the cues, and I think what, you know, of course, what's revolutionary about that film is the usage of reenactments.
Right.
But the usage of the reenactments are very banal. And they're very just shots.
Right.
And details.
Right.
And what is so powerful for that movie for me is that Morris is creating signposts for you to be able to come back to and draw associations with as a viewer.
Exactly. So there's, so it's this notion of repetitive imagery. And I think that's what's so signature of this thing, is that you're continually going back to the same shots, but now they have new meaning with each lap.
And that you don't go back as much as you think.
I know, right?
Which is amazing. Which
yeah.
Is, so I think, that, you know, the seminal, that I think I wrote down somewhere in my notes, there's the different shots that we come back to, but the most important shot is the milkshake. And so, you know, in the testimony of one of the detectives talking about, you know, or one of the attorneys talking about that night. So what you first see is a car being pulled over, a detective coming to the side of a car, the partner getting out of the car and standing at the back of the car, which is proper police procedure.
Right.
The driver of the car pulls out a gun, shoots the officer at the window of the car. The car drives away.
Yep.
The officer at the back of the car shoots towards the car.
Right.
That is the story that's told. That's the visuals that you're presented with.
Right.
Which is one version of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know at that point because you don't have enough information.
Mm-hmm.
As the story goes on, there's a moment in which we learn that before this happened, they went to a Burger King. The car also went to a Burger King, which is where they saw the car. And they purchased milkshakes,
mm-hmm.
or at least the passenger in the police vehicle purchased a milkshake. And there's a, you know, someone in an interview says, well, they found a milkshake to the side
right.
of the road, a certain number of feet away from the car.
Right.
Which would probably denote the fact that the person was sitting in the car when this whole thing transpired, which is totally against procedure,
mm-hmm.
threw the milkshake and jumped out of the car.
Right.
And that's the idea that he plants in you with the milkshake.
Yeah.
Is he shows you the milkshake and he tells you this narrative detail. And that narrative detail is shared as speculation.
Mm-hmm.
That this makes the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
So now the film progresses. You go way deep. Now you're near the end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that Randall Adams at this point didn't do it.
Right.
You've seen who, you know, how David Harris is portrayed and all that.
Right.
And we go to, again, let me look at my notes here.
Yeah.
There's a precise moment.
Yeah.
Where it happens.
I'm waiting with bated breath.
Yeah.
Right?
So when they're talking about the testimony
yeah.
of the officer.
Yeah.
And they're talking about, and Adams is actually talking about the testimony of this officer.
Right.
And they said, if you listen to what she said the moment after it happened, she said this happened.
Right.
And then if you listen to the testimony that was made in court, she says something else entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
And she spent time with internal affairs or she was coached in some way.
Yep.
And when he mentions this detail and when he says mm-hmm. that she was coached, the image that comes back is a milkshake flying through the air.
Right.
So as an audience, what Morris has done is recalled this very banal, simple detail.
Yeah.
But he included it so that he doesn't have to explain the whole conversation again.
Exactly.
And on a subconscious level, as an audience member, if you're tracking the story,
yeah.
and which is why I suggest watching Wormwood in one sitting, because you can track all the details that are transpiring.
Yes.
You know, that to me is his power. In that moment, he shows one shot.
Yes.
The same thing happens when David Harris is recounting the timeline,
mm-hmm.
and he says, I went and got popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
And it cuts to the TV Guide and the Carol Burnett Show,
mm-hmm.
which reminds you of the accuracy mm-hmm. of Randall Adams' memory and the fact that he said he was doing these things. So Morris, forget documentary, forget everything. He's a linguist
mm-hmm.
who is visually helping the audience
mm-hmm.
put the pieces together so he doesn't have to constantly re-explain it.
Exactly.
And I think for us, when we work together and when we aspire to do things that resonate,
mm-hmm.
you want to find those visual cues to be able to give the audience information without having to explain it again.
Yeah.
And he broke documentary genre with that ability.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. And it's like poetry. It's literally the economy of words and through the use of imagery. And so, like you're saying, you don't have to continue to do it. And not only that, it also is, he's overlapping meaning. So you're continuing to layer meaning with and associations with this different imagery over time that shifts and changes. So to me, what he does best is he's at once grounding and destabilizing
mm-hmm.
with each image and these words.
I just want to explode because it's like, that's exactly right. And what
yeah.
he does in Wormwood is just completely break any rule that's been established
yeah.
and deliver exactly what you're saying, destabilize. Do you want to?
Let me give a little moment
please.
On Wormwood for a second
yeah,
because,
please.
So Wormwood, just a little synopsis here, six-part series on Netflix right now. It's a little over 4 hours. In the nutshell, it's about Frank Olson, an American biological warfare scientist and CIA employee who died under mysterious circumstances. And it's told primarily through his son, Eric Olson, who was 9 years old at the time of his father's death. And it's also told about his pursuit to find the truth, to find this, like, what really happened to my father. And it's a ride and a half. That's just the very basic version. I'm not going to go too deep into that.
Yeah. So to spice up the conversation.
Yeah.
Sort of go in the revelation that I had last night when I was revisiting some of Wormwood, just to sort of collect some of my thoughts and dig more into the essence of what I was responding to. I think what I feel like is going on with Errol Morris, and I think it can be encapsulated in Thin Blue Line, and then it can be encapsulated in these bookends, it's a battle between objectivity and subjectivity.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
And I truly believe that documentaries are perceived as being objective.
Right.
That's just a fact.
Mm-hmm.
I think before the Thin Blue Line, there was an unspoken rule about what a documentary can do or couldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
But what everybody else who hasn't been in the editing room of a documentary, what they don't know,
right,
is that we subjectively choose what sound bites serve the story that we want to tell.
Right.
And by the way, it's more subjective than a feature film.
Right.
Because the material's been collected and you're not just writing it.
I mean, right.
You know, you're choosing and mm-hmm. you're re-editing and mm-hmm. you're fixing things to make it serve the greater story that you want to tell.
Right.
So I think that with the Thin Blue Line, what Errol Morris did is overtly created a subjective element to it mm-hmm. in order to help you track the story.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But the presentation of those reenactments mm-hmm. is incredibly objective.
Right.
It is banal.
Mm-hmm.
It is void of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
It is fact-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
The shots are beautiful.
Right.
They're simple, mm-hmm. but they're factually based. You see a person walk up to a car. You see a hand pull a gun. You see a gun shoot. You don't see someone calculating.
Mm-mm.
You don't see someone regretting.
Mm-mm.
None of that. So for me, Thin Blue Line lives on the side of objectivity in this bookend.
Right.
Wormwood.
Right.
Is entirely subjective.
Yeah.
To great success.
Yeah.
And Wormwood, and I think sort of what is groundbreaking about it and what kicks it out of sort of the traditional documentary place is that Errol Morris is employing scripted and written scenes starring Peter Sarsgaard,
mm-hmm.
who masterfully plays Frank Olson in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And just the opening of the film, mm-hmm. if you watch it, Frank, and this is not giving anything away, Frank Olson is in an apartment in New York City. He's sitting with a mysterious person who's smoking cigarettes. They're watching a fight on television. He begins to read from the Bible. Something doesn't feel right to him.
Mm-hmm.
He gets up.
Mm-hmm.
He looks out his peephole.
Mm-hmm.
He sees himself floating in water.
Mm-hmm.
It's very trippy.
Mm-hmm.
It's very weird.
Mm-hmm.
He goes outside into the hallway.
Right.
He reappears on the opposite side of the frame without crossing in front of the camera. You're sort of thrown off balance. There's a sense of paranoia. He
yeah.
comes into the room. He looks at the window. And then you cut to a beautiful title sequence mm. where he's falling through the window.
Yeah.
And there's a Perry Como song
yeah.
that plays. And the lyrics are incredible when you've watched the movie.
Right.
Just the snippets to say out loud is there's one line that says, "Hurry home, come home to me,
mm-hmm.
set me free, free from doubt and free from longing. Into your arms I'll fly,"
mm-hmm.
which is an incredible song from that era in which this event
yep.
happened
yep.
that is exactly about Eric Olson's longing
yes.
and wanting to be set free from this terrible mystery with his father.
Yes.
So back to the subjectivity. Those dramatic scenes
yeah.
are highly subjective.
Mm-hmm.
They are not banal and simply photographed.
Mm-mm, no.
It is full of nuanced performance from Peter Sarsgaard.
Yeah.
And what I think blew the top of my head off was you watch the Thin Blue Line knowing what it did in documentary, and then you watch Wormwood and see a highly subjective, highly emotional, nuanced, it's no longer a reenactment, this is a film.
Oh, yeah.
But that now puts you in the story and helps you relate to a character that you've never heard from.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. And so you identify with Frank Olson
mm-hmm.
throughout the movie,
mm-hmm.
no matter what happens. And those sort of dramatic instances are based on recounting from the Colby Report, which was a report that was published about what happened.
Yeah, in 1975.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
Eric's father.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really are in the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of esoteric term, but it's like I think the goal is to pull the audience into the story.
Yeah.
To make them feel like they're participating in what's happening. And David Mamet wrote that one amazing line about when you can calibrate the audience so that when the character has the epiphany, they have it too.
Right.
It's the best payoff.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's calibrating
Yes.
The audience's ability to connect
mm-hmm.
with what was really going on for Frank Olson.
So let me talk about some like a little thought I had about that related to this. He drops the Interatron in this.
Yeah.
Now, he didn't really have it in Thin Blue Line.
He didn't drop it. It doesn't serve any purpose in this story.
It's not a first-person account. There are no first-person accounts in this either.
You're totally right. But I think the Interatron, to a degree, dehumanizes the subject.
Right.
I don't think you have what they did in the Defiant ones
mm-hmm.
without Fog of War and SOP.
Of course.
Because there are awkward moments that only exist when the person is staring at the camera and they're destroying the audience. And it's like, that's just soup. You just lap that up.
Right.
I think in this story, what was so powerfully important is to see Errol Morris sitting at a table with Eric Olson.
Right.
Because it humanizes him. And the first shot of Eric Olson sitting down, you hear Errol's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an over-the-shoulder shot where Errol Morris is mm-hmm. dirty in the frame. And
right.
that is totally calculated that they picked that shot to start the interview with.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's participatory.
Absolutely.
I think.
It's that. It's absolutely that. Like, you're having a conversation. You yourself are Errol Morris. You are asking those questions.
You are listening.
You're listening, and you're, like, thinking, and you're engaged.
Yeah.
But it's also that, in my reading, partially, too, and is you're also listening to an unreliable narrator. And you're going to be throughout this film in a certain kind of way because they weren't there.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And all they can ever do is just milk
rehash.
Rehash.
Yeah.
That's all we're going to get.
Yeah.
And maybe that's all we're ever going to get. You know?
Well, and he does some, just staying on this topic of interviews
mm-hmm.
and sort of in framing, he does something totally groundbreaking
uh-huh.
for a documentary, which is at like 9 minutes in.
Yeah.
There's a wide shot
yeah.
of Eric Olson,
mm-hmm.
and there's a clock in the top left corner of the frame.
Right.
Now, if you're shooting a fictional movie, someone goes and they just change the time to match it back in. But if you're shooting an interview of a documentary, the moment I saw that, I was like, okay. I mean, I just immediately my eye went and I said, the next time I see that shot, did that clock move? The first time I watched it, I felt that way. And it doesn't move.
It doesn't move.
Because it's stuck at the time that his father died, which represents Eric being stuck.
He's stuck.
On that moment.
Yeah.
Not to mention that the whole thing starts with the door
yes.
of the room being closed, and you see, you know, 1018A at the Statler Hotel.
Yeah.
And the door's not open.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so he's stuck in time, and what happened in that room is sort of unknowable.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All
right, so there's so many.
I mean, there's so much to do. It's hard also to have the focused conversation about it because I think that there's so much that's going on. I mean, the first episode.
Let me just bring that because it's like also something really like with your very much in your filmmaking background too. Mm-hmm. The multiple like aspect ratios and framing and mm-hmm. the split screens in Wormwood.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I mean, I think, you know, there's an extraordinary thing I'm using.
This is new for Morris. Did he ever use split screens before? I don't remember him ever using split.
I don't know. There's.
He's used frame and frame, I think, picture in picture.
I think there's a couple of instances to me that this really stands out. Again, about 11 and a half minutes into the film,
yeah.
you see someone on the news talking about the Rockefeller Report.
Right.
Which is this damning report about the wrongdoings of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts
in relation to Frank Olson's death.
Not
in
yet.
Part.
Not
but
yet.
Okay, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Not yet.
Not
right.
yet.
Okay.
But they just talk about this
mm-hmm.
coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they realize that
yes.
part of this report is this thing, but it doesn't call out Frank Olson. It
no.
says someone, there was a death, and that leads them to Seymour Hersh, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But in that moment, it's wonderful. There's a television against a very period wall.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very period television.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the news in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the camera completely cuts to a split screen.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's full screen on the left of that news.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the television on the right.
Right.
And for me, my initial thing when I kept watching the film, the two words that came to my mind were content and context.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that shot means to me.
Got it.
Here's the context in which people were viewing this information.
Right.
And then here's the detailed content.
Right.
So there's a sense of you
mm-hmm.
watching it as the viewer from the past on the TV.
Yeah.
And you watching it as a viewer in the present.
Yeah.
Full frame on the left side of the frame. That's one instance.
Because, as people probably who don't make films know, that the picture-in-picture in that little TV, that is the right aspect ratio.
Right.
That is the correct aspect rate. It is that small compared to the aspect ratio we are working with today with
HD.
Okay.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's one instance that he you know, sort of plays with that for me. And it comes back to us again and again.
Mm-hmm.
Then you see Eric Olson being interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very powerful moment in this sequence of time where, you know, Eric Olson is actually in the past.
Yeah.
Talking about how they met with the president and its news footage and how that gave them a great sense of completion or a great sense of relief.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately preceding that shot, you see Eric Olson in the present tense expressing regret.
Yes.
So there's a wonderful juxtaposition in these editorial choices of allowing the archive to tell you, oh, dude, there's so much more to this story. And by the way, like, watch the whole thing. We're going to show you everything.
Yeah.
The other split-screen thing that he does is this visual emphasis that I think is quite wonderful, where, you know, Eric Olson is talking about all these interpretations and all these thoughts, and the screen goes into just a Brady Bunch type of collage.
Right.
And there's an echoing quality in the audio.
Yep.
And that is the sort of this confusion doubled down of not I'm lost, but it gives you this sense, you know, that you're sort of fighting something, that there's so many points of views, there's so many possibilities.
Yeah.
It's impossible
to know.
To know.
Mm-hmm.
He breaks another rule early in the first episode. I think the first episode is just all the clues and the ingredients for the whole series, for the whole film.
Yeah.
Where Eric Olson talks about being told as a child about his dad dying, and he goes to Vin Rouette's house. He's telling the story. You're staying at Vin Rouette's house. You're seeing the actor playing Vin Rouette, ominous shots of him, and how Rouette was critical of him because he something about, let's see if I have a note here.
Because
he says, not well adjusted. He was seen as not well adjusted.
Right.
In the eyes of Rouette. And what Errol Morris does is he flips the shot. So he just takes, you're totally used to the key light being on the character's left side of their face, and they're framed on the left side of the frame. So you're totally used to that. And he says, you know, I was seen as not well adjusted. The camera flips. It's totally jarring.
I totally remember that. I missed that.
And this is, again, Morris at his best.
Yeah.
And Stephen Hathaway. I mean. I mean.
The editor. Yeah, Stephen Hathaway.
Their collaboration is so delicious. And we can learn so much from it. But right away. You're being told. You're cued. And then later, he doesn't need to go to the 20 split screens anymore. He just goes to a couple. And then he uses the same reverb effect on the dialogue. And you know.
Yeah.
It's an emotional marker as an audience member to know.
Yes.
Okay, I'm at a point where this person feels isolated or feels like it's too big for them or,
yes,
you know.
And this echoing feeling, this cavernous feeling.
And it's literally imposing that aesthetic onto pre-shot imagery.
Yeah.
It's not even like shooting a scene. It's just taking two interview shots and putting them there and adding a reverb effect.
Which is crazy that it's so simple, but yeah, really, really. Which reminds me of the European documentary filmmakers, because there's a simplicity to what they're doing, but it's so impactful.
Yeah.
And what it comes down to at the end of the day, I think, is this very sensual experience. Morris's filmmaking in Wormwood is literally visceral. You have entered this world, and it's strange and it's uncomfortable. Its sights and sounds are weird. You yourself feel off balance and destabilized. I found myself, because Eric Olson is so incredibly intelligent, and his presentation, he's been living with this now for decades.
Yeah.
And his retelling of it is almost, I wouldn't say matter of fact, but in a certain way, they're running out of clip too.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this rich conversation, and he's like just boom, boom, boom. And you're like, what the heck is going on here? You know, that alone, just the way he's telling it, is a bit unnerving. given the fact of the subject matter.
Yeah.
But then also, too, what's going on around and what Morris is doing as a filmmaker, all these choices, like you're saying, just puts you in this world and in this space, not to mention all the archive of him and his father.
Which is like, what a lucky, like, I mean, that's just a gift.
Yeah.
And but there's something to be said about, there's a moment near the very end of the film. I'll see if I have it.
An archive moment. Him and his dad.
Near the end of the film. Mm-hmm. It's not just him and his dad.
Mm.
It's actually just Olsen alone.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And what happens,
yeah.
Let's see if I have it here. What happens is the registration is off. Image.
Okay. Yep.
And so we've seen this archive sort of presented perfectly.
Right.
And then at the very end,
yeah.
when Olsen talks about his damage and he talks about sort of how, you know, it has all affected him.
Right.
The archive is presented differently.
Yeah.
The registration is off. Mm-hmm. The frame is cut off at the top. There's a line, you know, at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 3/4 of the way down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You haven't seen it that way before.
Right.
The same thing. It's, you know, gosh, there's the shots of Eric Olsen digging with a shovel.
Yeah.
Those shots are used exactly when he's talking as a grown-up about starting to dig for what's the real story.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Unbelievable,
it's, right? Yeah.
It's but I think it goes back to, like, the moment in the Thin Blue Line where the detective, the Dallas detectives who seemingly know everything, are like,
quote unquote,
and
yeah.
we put out the APB for the comet. I mean, the Vega. And it's, you know, the person stumbles
yes.
over the truth
yes.
in an interview.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's the story.
That's the story. That's the story. And so this whole thing, too, that, do you think it does Morris do anything just, you know, by accident? No, they're
yeah.
all meaningful choices
yeah.
that he is making.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
He's going to keep that stumble in there
yeah.
to let you know.
Yeah.
What was it? Was it Gottlieb who he yeah. who's he's his story later on? He couldn't keep the cover up. You know, he one of Frank Olson's, you know,
was the head of
colleagues.
The program. Yeah.
yeah, who was yeah. the head of the program. He couldn't continue to say the same line because he was like, oh, which one is the cover up and which one's the real story?
That's right.
That started to blend at
that's
a certain
right.
point.
I mean, with age and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where I think the film just goes in an incredible direction is there's this notion of serendipity and there's this, which I think is incredibly powerful. And as you and I both
mm-hmm.
sort of prescribe
mm-hmm.
to this belief that sort of, not that things happen for a reason, mm-hmm. but it's like, my grandfather had a quote, you know, life best fits the man, luck best fits the man dressed for it.
Right.
And I think you welcome the opportunities that happen to you.
Right.
And there's all this, there's, you know, Seymour Hersh is, you know, introduced in the first
episode. Yeah.
And he basically says, you must be the most uncurious family in America.
Right.
And then Seymour Hersh is at the end of the film refusing to reveal the subjects, which basically validated the whole
yeah.
story.
Yeah.
So there's
yeah.
just this incredible symmetry about how all these people were in each other's life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the sort of unspoken symmetry of Eric Olsen's story is that Errol Morris was the absolute right candidate to tell this story.
Oh, yeah. By
and,
far.
And I don't think you can justify or validate putting or assembling this as
mm-hmm.
anything other than what it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just, it's an overwhelming, you know, piece of work. There's,
yeah.
you know, when very early in the film, you know, at the center of the conspiracy.
Right.
With Frank Olsen is this idea that potentially the U.S. did use biological weapons in Korea,
mm-hmm.
and that Frank Olsen knew this,
mm-hmm.
and him knowing this and him being sort of tired or not cool with this
mm-hmm.
was a liability.
Right.
And he was executed, assassinated.
As a result.
As a result of knowing that.
Right.
The first recreation that's really the first dramatic sequence that you see with Peter Sarsgaard as Frank Olsen, he's in a car.
Right.
They're driving.
Right.
And on the radio, they talk about U.S. POWs being captured and revealing information about this happening.
Right.
They just turned the radio to a different channel.
Channel.
Doesn't register it at all.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. then later in that episode,
mm-hmm.
they start getting into and they start talking about the value of keeping secrets and how important it is to be keep secrets, and that they were that Frank was actually at this getaway to be tested,
right,
as to whether or not he could be trusted,
right.
But that detail of that in that dramatic sequence, mm-hmm, being planted that early on, mm-hmm, multiple viewings, you really, really, really start to see, mm-hmm, the calculation of this narrative being unfolded,
mm-hmm,
and the subtlety and the nuance.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. And the digging that Eric had to do all along the way. So Morris is, in a way, making us go through that same process.
Oh, he does. Uncomfortably, right? So. To the point where when Eric exhumes his father's body.
Oof, yeah.
And you and the,
and
be-
you s- the best. Yeah, I mean, how much do we tell? I mean,
well, no, but I think, you know. I think the power of that,
yeah,
the power of that sequence is that you are getting highly uncomfortable,
yeah,
in that sequence,
mm-hmm,
and Morris knows that you will,
mm-hmm,
and then you're relieved,
yeah, mm-hmm, yeah,
and then Morris works his magic,
yeah,
and to the point that everything that I think, you know, I've listened to some podcasts about it, and I can't stop sort of consuming information about it. I'm really curious about the process of when they wrote the dramatic sequences and sort of how they decided,
yeah,
to implement them. I think, you know, Errol Morris's ability to shoot a scene from multiple angles and have it reveal a lot is crazy. Usually,
yeah,
you know, Fincher has the thing, there's one way to shoot the scene and that's the way you shoot it. But he constantly is peeling it back and peeling it back. And,
mm-hmm, and relaying different versions,
right,
and different angles and keeping it fresh and
but still preserving the emotional integrity of Frank Olson.
Yeah.
Which goes back to that notion of subjectivity that I think is so important in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Is that as a documentary, it's hard to relate to characters that you never hear from.
Right.
Right? So if Morris is making a detective story about no one who was at the scene of the crime, well, he's just going to construct in a very banal way the scene of the crime,
right,
so that you as a viewer can fill in the gaps and have,
right,
a sense as to maybe what happened. But then when you talk about a man who is incredibly conflicted about his profession and about what he's going to do and all the things that he's going through and what could or couldn't have happened, you know, your ability to relate to the wrongdoing of what happened with Frank, the internal struggle that he could have had is heightened by that ability of continually seeing Frank Olson in these flashbacks and learning more about him in every way. Even if what you're seeing isn't what happened, it's still getting under the surface of who he is,
mm-hmm,
and it's making you emotionally attached to him. And I just have never seen that happen before. Usually it's just archive that services that emotional connection. But Sarsgaard,
mm-hmm,
delivers like this just profound emotional connection to someone that you never hear from in the entire film, ever.
I mean, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about the state of the union right now,
yeah,
and where we're at,
yeah,
with our relationship to truth,
yeah,
and knowing. And, you know, this other thing where, like, in many and almost all of Morris's films, he uses newsprint. And he does, again, in this very masterfully. And we,
mm-hmm,
can get into the graphics and the design and,
yeah,
all that stuff. But it's this once very fresh and modern, but also a throwback,
yeah,
you know. And so I feel like what is interesting to me as a documentary filmmaker is I'm always concerned with building that emotional connection and making sure that you have that there. I'm like, are we at such a state now, or are we so advanced now in a certain way with our own, you know, viewing vocabulary and ability that Morris is like saying, we have got to have some sort of emotional connection to this material for us to change things, for us to understand it, for us to get into it in a way that can move the needle a bit. I don't know if that's his agenda per se.
Yeah.
But that marriage between the emotional content and some very, you know, pretty like standard, basic, dry content, you know, like forms and information and a basic retelling of these things, like really capturing that in a way where you give a shit about it. You,
yeah,
care.
Yeah.
You want to do something about it.
Yeah. Well,
much like propaganda, I guess, in,
yeah,
a certain kind,
I mean,
of way.
There's an incredible moment in the film. I think it's in the fourth or fifth episode where they show Colby
mm-hmm.
from the CIA who published the Colby Report,
right.
which detailed what happened. And he has a line basically saying, like, and that's all. He literally says on camera in archive, and that's all I know or we know about that mm-hmm. in regards to what happened in the room that night.
Mm-hmm.
And what's incredible about that
mm-hmm.
is as an audience, we have seen five different things that could have happened in that room that night
mm-hmm.
up to that point
right.
with a character that we are actually kind of in love with.
Yeah.
So we feel lied to.
Right.
And that serves the story that Morris is telling. Like, Colby is lying, by the way.
Yeah.
Because he does know. Someone does know. There mm-hmm. is, I mean, Morris has a great quote about, you can always find out the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you will or not is a different story because history is perishable, as he says, which I love that.
Yeah.
But really, that was a seminal, that was like a big light bulb
Boom.
Moment for me. When mm-hmm. Colby says that, I was like, dude, you're, like, how can you, like, I've seen it.
Yeah.
And that emotional reaction from me
mm-hmm.
just showed me how much Morris was doing right
mm-hmm.
in the movie by choosing this highly subjective style
mm-hmm.
for doing these dramatic sequences.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was emotionally attached to the man who was in this room. It was Peter Sarsgaard. He embodied that character.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, back to your point, I would never want to talk about an agenda of Errol
yeah.
Morris. I
yeah.
mean, I think he is a masterful storyteller who seeks the truth or the ability to articulate the complexities of the stories that he's chasing down
mm-hmm.
in service of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, there's been a great injustice, you know, if the government can execute someone in this manner and never be accountable for it, it sets a challenging precedence.
Yeah.
But I think that there's the boxing phrase, styles make fights. Like, I just think that
yeah.
for whatever reason, and thank God, you know, him and his team decided this was the way to tell this story.
Yeah.
And they did.
Yeah.
And I think it's more of a reaction to wanting to continue to push the medium.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Wanting to push himself as a filmmaker.
Right.
And just, like, who cares?
Yeah.
You need this objective.
Yeah.
It's not objective. Like, Eric Olson's story is entirely subjective.
Yes.
And his father was a human being.
Yes.
Who was probably incredibly conflicted about something that we would all be conflicted about. The majority of us would be conflicted about.
Mm-hmm.
So let's emotionally put you in a state where you...
you feel that and resonate that
yeah.
and explore that world.
Yeah.
There's a quote that I love by Morris, and I'm going to find it really quick. Hang on a sec. There's so many in this
and we
film.
Haven't even talked about Hamlet yet.
Oh my God, Hamlet. Okay. I could see the frame, but I couldn't see the picture. So that's like a film noir, you know, like that's one of Morris's favorite quotes.
From Out of the Past.
Yes.
Robert Mitchum.
With Robert Mitchum. Yeah. yeah. And it's just like when that came on, I was like, holy shit, that's it. That's
and
everything.
That's him. That's almost him as Emily in
yeah.
The Thin Blue Line.
Yes. Yes.
With Emily saying she fancied herself, you know.
Yes.
That's himself. And that's why Morris is one of the great self-reflexive filmmakers.
Yes.
Like, this is his brain.
Yes. He is that private detective. And he was one. And
yeah.
so that's the whole thing.
Yeah.
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 yeah. And it's great. It's just the frame, when he said that, when he first put the frame on, you know, remember the door is closed
mm-hmm.
and you see the window? It's a dramatic
mm-hmm.
Scene, and you're inside Frank Olson's home, and he's getting ready to go, you know, to the retreat. And basically, the door, you see the front door from inside,
right.
and outside is this car, you know,
yeah.
and it's just framed perfectly. And you're just like, what's going to happen? You know, what's going to happen now?
Yeah. And that visually, I was watching those sequences again, and that frame comes back. That's another reference to the frame.
Yes.
To
and
the frame within
the frame.
Right, which is, you know, Elia Kazan did that in East of Eden when
yes.
it was, you know, very widescreen, and he was framing things sort of in a 4:3 aspect
yeah.
ratio because that's what they were used to at the time.
Yeah.
Errol Morris is a filmmaker who understands the language of films, who understands how to frame a shot, shoot a shot with visual elements that trigger emotions.
Exactly.
And intellectually stimulate you.
So let's go into Hamlet, because we've got to talk about a little bit, and we have like 3 minutes. So let's just really briefly, Hamlet becomes a thread in the film.
It comes in at about, it comes in at, I believe, about,
first episode.
It's in the first episode.
I can't remember.
I have to move one of my pieces of paper here, but it comes in at about 36 minutes.
Okay.
Into the first episode. And, 36 minutes and 30 seconds. And he asks Eric Olson about the parallels of Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
With Hamlet's father saying, "Remember me."
Mm-hmm.
And they cut back to the old Laurence Olivier version of Hamlet, which, again, is very Errol Morris. Go back to the history of cinema. Go back to our visual memory of things. Go back to the memory bank of how we've processed these stories visually.
Right.
And you see this smoke. Which is very important.
Yes.
Because when Peter Sarsgaard, in a flashback or in a dramatic scene a little bit later, goes into the water in this weird, trippy, LSD-induced state, there's smoke.
Smoke.
And it's this capturing of these aesthetics and meshing. But the idea was that, you know, Hamlet's father dies.
Mm-hmm.
Hamlet's father tells him that this great injustice has been done.
As a ghost.
As a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Comes to him and tells him Hamlet comes back and wreaks havoc, destroying the world and ultimately destroying himself.
Yeah, and trying to figure it out and rectify
and not making the right choices in figuring it out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this there's a really wonderful parallel there, and that Hamlet visual keeps coming up.
Yep.
That's, again, why I think the first episode still serves as such a wonderful appetizer for the whole series, because all the nuggets, and it should be, it's the first act.
Yeah.
But all the nuggets are there, and there's of course a line in Hamlet where, you know, while the play is happening, the play that's staged to out Claudius, you know, Hamlet says, "Wormwood, wormwood."
Yes.
You know, which is a reference to bitterness, which of course goes back to the biblical reference of wormwood,
the star. Mm-hmm.
And so there's, you know, it's that wonderful thing about knowing and not knowing why the title is so perfect.
Yes.
Right? The perfect title, you know why it's perfect, but I don't want to take 5 hours to say why, because I'm probably wrong, but that's just why I think it's perfect.
Yeah, yeah, and it comes full circle, which is so great. So,
but what was your connection with the Hamlet, you know, thing?
Oh, again, it's like I love the choice of going back to the Laurence Olivier, and again, that's where Eric Olson and the era of where it would have happened in that moment. I didn't connect the smoke until you just said it, and that's great. I love that point of entry and that reference. And it was this whole idea of, do you really want to know? I guess that's what kept coming up for me.
Yeah.
Do you really want to know the truth?
Yeah. And I think the answer is yes. And I think, I think Thin Blue Line is his seminal work. I think this is his seminal work. I think this is Errol Morris relating.
Yeah.
Deeply to a man trying to find answers in all the films that he's shared with us and the books that he's written, and, you know, how he looks for truth in the world and is a detective.
Yeah.
But I think that there's this wonderful relationship with him and Eric Olson in this, that the Hamlet builds sympathy for someone who's in over their head, who doesn't know quite what to do.
Yeah.
But I think that the crafting of this film has made Eric's plight, I mean, I'm sure he has personal consequences and all of those things, like all of us do, that no one know about in the encapsulation of a conversation over the course of a film.
Yeah.
But it's a noble effort.
Yes.
That he's embarked on.
Yeah.
And it deserves celebrating.
Yes.
I think that's a lifetime search for truth.
Yes.
That actually reveals answers.
That's true. It does.
Sheds light.
Unfortunately, we have to go. Shed light. Ooh, I like that. That's good. So thank you so much, Jacob Rosenberg, for coming on and discussing with me. I mean, we probably could go 3 more hours, guys. but please check out Wormwood on Netflix. It's amazing. Thank you for listening to another episode of Doc Talk. This is Carol Martori, and I will talk to you guys next month. Bye-bye.